The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Welcome back. That was a short break. We didn't even get out of our chairs. You are listening to We the People Radio. I hope you will join us online because, you know what, a lot of people are joining us online. Let's see, brief commercial break on that
one. Many of them in Montana.
Yeah, you know, but honestly, I did a little homework. I know you find that shocking. We are now over 48,000 hits on the website since December of, 2014? So in almost 14 months, we've been doing all right. People are actually, people are actually tuning in and really listening and stuff. So we would, I kind of forgot to put out my pitch at the beginning, but I really do hope you'll go to the website and contact us, send us guests, ideas for programs, and especially if you'd like somebody to sponsor the program, they'll get good visibility here. We also air on the East Coast Mondays from 1 to 3 Eastern Time on the Conservative Commandos Radio Network. So get a lot of good exposure, and we get to educate folks on both sides of the aisle and both sides of the country. So let's see. All right, Elaine, back to you.
And to your credit, Aaron and Bill, you handle very heavy, controversial issues with a light heart, and I think that's invaluable. I think that's
kind of our saving grace.
You're fun to listen to, even if it's a tough subject, and I appreciate that.
Well, we found that if we don't handle it that way, you just end up being haters, you know. And
well,
nobody wants that. You can't really have a conversation when it goes down that road.
True, it's hard to learn stuff. So Bob throws in a bunch of fun music, I know some people think like, "What do these guys just screw around all the time?" Not exactly. I mean, this is a tough topic. Because
it can come off
like you don't like, that you're anti-Native American. And that's how I'm sure you get pegged a lot. Correct.
It does seem like that. And every time you disagree with a tribal government decision, if you dare to disagree or even speak up, you're a racist. And there used to be 5 or 6 national organizations studying this issue. And they were all demeaned and smeared so badly they've disappeared, except for our Citizens Equal Rights Alliance. We were equally smeared, and we continue to be called a hate group, an anti-Indian, and all this and that. But there's information that has to be made known. And so you can call me or our organization any name you want. We're staying on track with getting this information out. And our original purpose was to assist tribal members, as they do not have the same protections you and I have. And they live a very different life. But most of them that are still on the reservations know nothing different. And so it's a sad, sad thing. But I would like to consider the first hour like background or history or yesterday. Mm-hmm. And spend this time talking about today.
Okay.
Because I really want to talk about what's happening in Montana. And but I want to lay a little background along with that, too. In the Western states, we have major river systems. You have the big Missouri River system, the Columbia River system, and these very big river systems. And the federal government, with the help of the Army Corps of Engineers and all those little alphabet agencies under the Secretary of Interior, have carved these arbitrary boundaries and made these major river watershed management, federal watershed management plans that take in, let's start with the Missouri River. Yeah, the Missouri River flows through 9 states. It takes every little creek and stream and tributary that feeds into the Missouri, and that becomes the management, the federal watershed management plan. That is put together, and for decades, that has been to promote and encourage crop production and farming and agriculture, to promote local businesses, to promote tourism, to protect the natural resources. Those have been shifted in the recent years. Those big federal watershed management plans have now been shifted to promote tribal sovereignty and then protect the sacred and cultural resources of Native Americans and then to protect the endangered species and the fish and wildlife issues. And way down at the bottom of the food chain on these federal watershed management plans is maybe there'll be a little irrigation left over for the crops. Now, those management plans are implemented by a team. And so there's 9 states in the Missouri watershed, and there's a lot of tribes. Each team, each state may have 1 representative on the implementation team. So there's 9 state representatives. There are 29 tribes in that area. They each get a representative. So on the implementation, you're in a group with 29 tribal voices and 9 state voices. And that's shifting everything in these major watershed management plans. That's going on today. The Columbia River is my favorite. That's 4 states. 4 states. Washington State, Oregon, Idaho, a little piece of Montana. So there's 4 states' representatives at the implementation team for the Columbia Basin Rivershed Water Management. That area, those 4 states have 53 tribes. Guess who's controlling the whole Columbia River Basin and all that salmon recovery act stuff and all your, and it even feeds down into and eventually impacts the Klamath area.
Right.
So these are federal programs that have shifted from public interest to tribal sovereignty. That's part of the game going on now. Here in Montana, it just shocks me to speak of this because I've just been stunned by what I've learned. I moved out here 6 months ago, and I thought I was coming out to help folks on the water, but it's about a lot more than that. But there is a Salish Kootenai Water Compact, Settlement Agreement, Water Compact, that was approved April 11th. We're going to say illegally approved April 11th by a state legislature by a rule changing in the Capitol that approved it by minority vote instead of 2/3 required by the Constitution. But the Salish Kootenai Water Compact is an agreement between the state of Montana, the Salish Kootenai tribe, and the federal government. And the end result of this compact is that 11 counties, all the little counties that border the Idaho Panhandle, 11 counties and 350,000 Montana citizens are directly or indirectly affected by this compact. That compact has to be ratified by Congress. And, of course, the folks here and the folks that I'm working with are going to be doing everything we can to see that it isn't ratified by Congress. But even if that compact didn't exist, what has happened is that the state of Montana has walked away in the compact, and for all practical purposes, even without it, they have walked away from their control or authority over all the waters in these 11 counties. And we have the big Flathead Lake here. We have a system that comes down out of Canada. We have abundant water that comes out. It comes down through some major dams, the Hungry Horse and the Kerr Dam. And all of this water has been put under the control of the Salish Kootenai tribe, with the state of Montana absolutely walking away. This reservation has an irrigation project. You remember the homesteaders, and this is predominantly non-Indian. We're a big growing area. My neighbor does 2 million in potatoes every year. We have cattlemen and whatnot. They rely on runoff from the mountains that feeds into the irrigation system, and they rely on the irrigation system. Currently, that big irrigation infrastructure is under the operation and management of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, though. What we have today in Montana is that the federal government or tribal government, federal government meaning the BIA or the United States, the federal government controls 100% access to all water. And then on the reservation, we have the Mission Valley Power Company that provides everyone's electricity. The Mission Valley Power Company is owned by the Bureau of Indian Affairs and managed by the tribal government. So the federal government controls 100% access and availability to all water, and they control 100% access to all electricity on this reservation. Do you need water and electricity for any livelihood on your land?
Well, the federal government controls the water on most most of the country, don't they? I mean, on and off reservations.
Yeah, but there's control managed by your by elected officials, and where you have public input, and then there's control where it's all done by somebody you can't get to. That's
and that's a good point, Aaron, because ordinarily all of this water is under and rate setting for power, rate setting for water, is under the review of your state public services commission. The state has walked away from that too. The water and power coming off of the dams, the wholesale rates, do not have to be reviewed by the Montana State Public Services Commission, and there's no ceiling. The retail rates coming out from Mission Valley Power are not subject to review, and there's no ceiling by the Public Services Commission. So what's happening here is a financial and energy economic squeeze on all of the agricultural industry here that is the linchpin. It is the economy. It is the absolute economy of about six towns. The landowners are being squeezed up. I'll give you a little example. One of my neighbors had 200 acres in peas. The week we moved here in July, there was a big heat wave, and the neighbor had 200 acres in peas that were just coming to peak, and he lost his irrigation water. It scorched 80% of his crop. About the time he salvaged 20% of his crop, they turned his water back on. We've had cattlemen here who lose their stock water, and they have to relocate hundreds of cattle to some other piece of ground that has water. And about the time the cattle get relocated, they'll turn the guy's stock water back on. Nasty games being played here.
Mm-hmm.
Against the very folks that helped them survive years ago. So it's sad times, but the biggest culprit is the state of Montana itself. Your governor here and your attorney general here and your legislators here have all absolutely abandoned 350,000 citizens in the western side of Montana. And they added $55 million of state taxpayer dollars into the compact to help the tribe do this to us. It's just a beast. But it is a model that will roll out across other
Well, see, we're already seeing too. That. And it's interesting. For the folks that live in the East, we make this comment all the time. They just don't have the federal land problems that we do out here in the West.
No.
But we see it here. They made an administrative law decision up in the Klamath that the tribe up there has time immemorial water right. Well, what the heck? So
isn't that cute?
Yeah. So your property just became worthless because without a water, obviously they're.
Yeah.
Before I go on a rant and we have to take, and we have to take a break here because it's like a pull the ripcord. David has called from Montana. He has a question for you, so want to make sure and don't hold him over forever. David, fire away.
Oh, excellent. Let me just turn this down real quick. The question is, I was curious if Elaine Willman is familiar with the book New Tactics of Global War, written by Jeff Nyquist, who spells out that Henry Kissinger, who happened to be our Secretary of State back in the Nixon days, and she mentioned Nixon, and this speaks to Henry Kissinger as being, per a British double agent by the name of Michael Golanowski, whereas he was on a list to be part of an accepted GRU, which was a group, a spy network known as Red Orchestra, the Road to Capella. He was on the list as being one of those folks brought into the Communist Party. And so this spells out, through Jeff Nyquist's book, which really starts to connect some interesting dots through the Nixon era, where Indian policy, especially in the state of Montana, with the Montana new constitution, has essentially adopted, I believe what Elaine can really speak well to, a direction that has led us down this path here locally, anyhow, in Montana, and then let's just say on a macro level, across the nation with regard to Turkey as a nation and maybe other nations to lease lands within certain or maybe all federally recognized reservations. And these lands are leased for 75 years. And it's just, it speaks to, essentially, the enemy in the shadows, which is driven by Russia intelligence. And anyhow, that was my question.
David, give me the author again, please.
Oh, sure. Jeff Nyquist, Nyquist, The New Tactics of Global War. Sun Tzu is... Anyway, that was my question.
That's awesome. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
David, I'm not
okay, Elaine, you have 2 minutes to think about your answer. We're going to squeeze in a quick break and come right back.
Okay.
Glad we're hearing from our folks up there in Montana.
Yeah.
That's probably snowing and stuff. It's a good day to listen to the radio. All righty, we'll be back with you. We're adding all this information. It's all on the website for you, wethepeopleradio.us. We hope you go there, send it to your friends, post it on Facebook, that kind of stuff, and share the info, because this is the only place you'll get this much of it on one topic.
Well, you filled up my head with so many lies. You twisted my heart till something snapped. Give a damn's busted.
Well, listen, everybody, to what I gotta say. There's hope for tomorrow. Here we come today.
There you go. We've hit all genres today. We've gone from Merle Haggard to Ted Nugent. We haven't had any Weird Al. You have that? Uh-oh. Sounds like Elaine got disconnected. Oh, no, it's David Hugg.
No, I didn't.
You're there.
I was hoping it wasn't.
Sorry.
I was hoping it wasn't my phone. I'm glad you caught it.
No, it was David.
Hey, Elaine, before we...
answer David.
Oh, is David still on?
No.
No, David's gone. I want to make sure we talk about what was going on with the Yakima reservation and the visitors that they had, and how that whole thing transpired.
Okay, I lived there for 16 years. I moved up in 92 to be their community development director and in Toppenish, Washington. And at the time, Toppenish was one of the most visited destinations in Washington State, because they have 75 magnificent murals on every building wall of the town. And the tourists from all over the world would come there to see real cowboys and real Indians and to take the covered wagon narrated tour around the murals, and Toppenish was thriving. And then the Yakima tribe got its, and mind you, that reservation is 80% Hispanic, the big farm area. It's 10% Indian and 10% Anglo. But it's nonetheless, it's a beautiful community where all those cultures grew up together and they never had problems with each other. They got along quite well. And then the Yakima tribe got its casino and put it right outside of town. And I had an office in downtown Toppenish, just 2 doors down from City Hall, and I used to love to hear the horse clopping on the streets when the tour was going by every 45 minutes. And those tours started reducing to, instead of every 45 minutes, is maybe twice a day and then maybe once a day. And then it became by appointment only because the casino was the big draw. And the tribal folks were shuttling people from the airport right directly to their casino. And the tourism industry pretty much dried up in downtown Toppenish. It sits like a little island, the municipality there, in the middle of an enormous reservation. And then the next thing to happen was our restaurants started closing down. Most of them did close down, and we intentionally frequented a couple of the favorite ones to keep them open as long as we could, because they could not compete with the big all-you-can-eat buffets out at the casino. And then the retail, with no tourists, the shops, the retail shops started closing down, and the city of Toppenish has taken a huge economic hit. And as those buildings would empty out from an empty restaurant or an empty retail shop, the tribe would go in and buy that building or lease that space so that Toppenish could not regenerate its revenue. This process, that was my direct experience in Toppenish for 16 years. And I actually served on the city council there. I resigned before moving to Hobart. And I was part of a 7-member council. We saw this happening, and I was part of 7 members, and I said, we have to fight back. We have to do something here. And 2 of us on the council were adamant about that, but 5 didn't want to be called a racist, didn't want to make a problem, so they did and have done nothing. And the town is really deteriorating. It's really in serious economic decline. Likewise, that same tribe tried to capture 2 of the dams and shut the water off for the farming industry there years ago. I was a part of, fortunately, we defeated that process. But that's an example. When I say there are more non-Indians and towns and counties on reservations than there are Indians, but if you have a tribal government that has a triple-digit million-dollar annual budget and you're up against a little town with a single-digit million-dollar operating budget, guess who's going to overpower you?
Oh, yeah.
And then,
you're doomed.
Yeah, and you can't sue them. But if they sue you, then you can respond. But then the federal government, our taxpayers, pay for all their legal fees. And the local communities cannot afford those big legal fees to fight back. It's very, very hard. So it's just a very overpowering process now that has truly ramped up, and it's going to happen right here on the Flathead. Now that they control all the water and the power, there's 3 counties on this reservation that will go into immediate economic decline, and these towns, the reservation above us, the Blackfoot, they've already got 1 town up there talking about having to disincorporate or go bankrupt on that reservation, and that's happening across the country. And the problem with that is if your general purpose government, if your municipality or county goes down and you're a citizen of the state, you're then under the governance of a tribal government that does not allow you to go to the meetings. You can't run for office. You can't vote. And it's literally the whole, you lose your representative government. And that's kind of the agenda, the big picture agenda. A lot of these reservations, they all want their land back. We were here first, And so they use these terms like Aboriginal in my favorite, time immemorial. Those are terms that come out of United Nations and some Canadian things. Those are terms that don't do well in the legal courts in the United States. But those are the big new buzzers now. It's our Aboriginal land. We've had it since time immemorial. We were here first. Well, if that were the case, if they were here first, then there's no possibility for equality in the United States. Because they were here first. Everything else is secondary. We didn't steal their land. Every bit of the ground was paid for, and through the Indian Claims Commission, some of the ground's been paid for 3 and 4 times, in addition to all the annual money they get. So we were here first, you stole your land. Those are the little chants that they run around urban America and D.C. with, when the reality is quite different. And this time immemorial, if time immemorial had any legal validity, there could not be a United States. They would trump everything.
Oh, yeah.
Now, what David was talking about, I've not read Mr. Nyquist's book, but it rings true with the stuff when I thought I was out here in Montana to help fight a water war. In the research we've been doing to develop our legal case that we will be filing in D.C., in the research that we've done over the recent months, we've discovered that much of the language of Agenda 21 and Agenda 2030 has now been expressly incorporated into federal Indian policy. And if you look at the maps that are posted on the Agenda 21, I used to think those were the Tin Hat people, but I believe it now. If you look at the maps on Agenda 21 information sites, you'll see the North American continent, and you'll see that it no longer has states. And part of the game of taking down the states is using these tribal governments and Indian reservations as launch pads when they have the states so dependent upon federal funding. You know, the White House can pick up the phone to a governor and say, you do it our way or we're pulling your federal funds. These states are no longer acting like states. Montana is the worst. Montana has absolutely abandoned its people in 11 counties, absolutely outright abandoned them. But Washington State, look at poor Washington State, 31 tribes in that state. Look at Oregon. And the one state that is still acting like a state is Idaho. I was just up there with some good people in Idaho and was able to meet with the leadership of their Idaho legislature, who are really looking at this and fighting hard as a state. But Montana is gone. The corruption in this state is profound. And the appeasement in this state is profound. Most of these northwestern states are not acting like states. That's why I so deeply believe in Ken Ivory and the American Lands Council. They're doing what they can to strengthen their states and fight back against this federal stuff. It's not the British coming anymore. It's our own federal government coming after our water, our energy, our crop production, the natural resources, the mining and uranium, coming after all of it out here. And the states are just going, oh, okay, oh, well. And the taxpayer is left picking up, you know, what the feds and tribes take away has to be offset by the remaining taxpayers in every state. And our taxes are going off the charts.
Well,
and our utilities are going off the charts.
And for those folks that haven't looked yet, I think you ought to go to the citizensalliance.org. Do you guys...
If I could correct you, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but it's citizensequalrightsalliance.com now. We recently upgraded our website, and it's now citizensequalrightsalliance.com.
I better update stuff because I'm looking at the journal.
I should have mentioned that.
But this is an old copy, although I thought it was the one you sent to us, and I really liked the whole thing, actually, but... It was
it's an old but timeless piece, and it was printed before we just upgraded our website just a few months ago, and so it's now citizensequalrightsalliance.com. I think maybe the old website might take you there.
It totally does. So citizensalliance.org does take you there because I posted off of it.
Yeah. Oh, good. Then we patched that. He's good.
It says, because this one part here says, in legal affairs, the latter takes precedence over the earlier. A latter law takes precedence over an earlier law. An amendment to the Constitution takes precedence over the original Constitution. Okay, so we all know that's true. And so it ties into this. A latter status of citizenship takes precedence over an earlier citizenship status. It could not be otherwise, or countries would be locked into an increasingly distant past, unable to adapt to either the present or the future. While tribal governments existed in this country before our Constitution, so did many other groups, including Native Hawaiians, Hispanics, French, Spanish, Dutch, and English. For example, white European males certainly also had governments in this country that predate the Constitution. While all this is true, it's also meaningless because the development of our country with its Constitution and citizenship essentially rendered these pre-existing statuses irrelevant. Making a special exception to this general rule for one group of people isn't functioning according to the law. It's functioning in violation of it. Indians, like all humans, do have a valid pre-existing inherent right, as explained in the Declaration of Independence and guaranteed in the Constitution. As individual American citizens, these rights should be recognized fully and equally by our government. So by making themselves separate, they actually cause themselves not to be covered by the Constitution, that is the ruling document for the country, and I can hear everybody going, unless Obama's reading it, and okay, I'm with you, I get it.
thank you, communist John Collier back in 1934. He's the one that twisted it backwards on that. But that's an excellent journal article that our top brains in our organization put together, and it is still timeless until we find some solutions. That's still the way it is.
It's just one of those things that I think people don't think about. I mean, they do. Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny. We have these conversations all the time. I just did this the other day. Someone said, well, how long do we owe a group of people special consideration? I mean, how long do they get to be more special than everyone else? And when does equality actually kick in? We have to take a really quick break on that cheerful note. We'll be... right back with you. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Oh, I like this song.
Oh, give me land, lots of land under starry skies above. Don't fence me in. Let me ride through the wide open country that I love. Don't fence me in. Let me be by myself in the evening breeze. Listen to the murmur of the cottonwood trees. Send me off forever, but I ask you please, don't fence me in, just turn.
You own whatever land you land on. The earth is just a dead thing you can claim. But I know every rock and tree and creature has a life, has a spirit, has a name. Think the only people who are people are the people who look and think like you. But if you walk the footsteps of a stranger, you learn things you never knew, you never knew. Have you ever heard the wolf cry to the blue corn moon? Or ask the grinning buckshot why he grins? Have you sing with all the voices of the mountains?
You're going to sing about wolves. We've got to cut this song off.
Yeah, don't
it's a terrible song. I liked it for a minute. Now it's over.
Yeah, I'm all into Pocahontas and everything, but we don't need the wolves.
Come on. It's from Pocahontas, by the way, just for all those people who didn't know that was Pocahontas. I didn't know it was Pocahontas.
It was Vanessa Williams singing on the soundtrack of Pocahontas.
Bob, you smoked this again. No pun intended. Oh, my gosh. All right, so Elaine, we're like, dang, we've got like 15 minutes left. Well, we've missed like tons
probably,
of stuff.
There's probably just, overloaded.
No, there's just a there ton are, of stuff we didn't do yet, so I'm panicking.
I know. There are two big pieces that are currently in play under this administration that are piling on to all that we've already talked about. And one is that the Obama administration has decided that energy is good economic development for tribal governments. And so billions are going out to tribes across the country to acquire major public utilities. And that was a part of the compact here, the Kerr Dam here in Montana, big Kerr Dam, part of the Columbia River system. It's also a Black Stark Dam, meaning that if power went out in the whole Northwest, that dam can restart itself and then power up some others. That dam was just given to the Salish Kootenai tribe. It was a public utility. It is now a tribal sovereign asset. They have no duty to keep the country safe. They have no duty to non-members. And they have a big dam. And that's the precedent. That's going to happen with dams. Remember I said back in 1921, the Secretary of Interior said all your dams and nuclear, all your energy sites needed to be on and near Indian reservations. Well, today they are. And it's long after September 11th, 2001. You know, when the Twin Towers fell, the biggest worry of the federal government was the grid system and the power. And so here we go. The second piece that Obama has implemented and Congress benignly consented to is that American businesses are a little reluctant to go on to to do business with tribal governments. Many of them have been burned. If they don't pay you, you can't sue them. And so American businesses are a little reluctant to go on to Indian or do direct business with tribal governments, other than vendors that supply some of their things. So Obama has decided that the big Middle Eastern money is good Indian economic development. And so in a HEARTH Act, H-E-A-R-T-H Act, HEARTH Act of 2012, the executive branch and Congress have now authorized Indian tribes to lease their private trust land. This is private trust land where state and county and local law enforcement eyes can't even look. They can long-term lease for up to 75 years their Indian trust land to Middle Eastern countries for purposes of economic development. Well, let's look at 340 reservations across the country, most of which have these private trust lands. And now the Middle Eastern company, Turkey in particular, this tribe, the Salish Kootenai tribe, has been engaged with Turkey in leadership exchanges and student exchanges. Turkey's going to come over here and build housing for the poor Indians. It begs the question, how's the housing in Turkey? But they're going to come over here and build, quote-unquote, housing for the Indians. So we're going to have these Middle Eastern folks who believe in a different religion. We're going to have little Sharia enclaves on Indian reservations right next to your major power and grid.
Wow.
And that is chilling, absolutely chilling.
Well,
and
that's,
that has a lot of the tribal members quite frightened themselves.
Well, look at the Yakima tribe. I mean, look at what's bordering their nation. We could talk a little bit about that.
Yes, it was really funny because when I wrote the book back in 2005, that was just 3 or 4 years after 9/11, and I was doing the book just following the road trip, and when my editor read the Homeland Insecurity chapter about what happened at the Yakima, he said, "You have to make this chapter one." And so Homeland Insecurity is chapter one. Now, this goes back to 2005. As I said earlier, I had a little office in downtown Toppenish, and our home was upstairs above it. And on a Sunday afternoon, I got a knock on the door downstairs at my office, and it was a tribal member I had never seen before, and he just handed me four pieces of paper. And he says, "This was on our radio station, Fax. I thought you should see it." And I looked at it, and it was a list of visiting journalists from a range of countries. Visiting journalists. They were out there in the middle of nowhere on the Yakima Reservation to visit their little radio station, which was maybe a 12-by-12 rented space with some hokey equipment, and they were there to visit the Yakima newspaper, which is a very good tribal newspaper. But it begged the question, these four pages were journalists from Yemen, Saudi Arabia, Tunisia. They were from all these Middle Eastern countries. And, you know, the tribe even took a photograph, and it was in the Toppenish Review newspaper, of these visiting journalists that just didn't mention the countries they were from. Well, the Big Yakima Reservation is surrounded on the north by Grand Coulee Dam, on the east by Hanford Nuclear Plant, across the Columbia River on the south by the Umatilla Chemical Weapons Storage Facility, and on the west by the Yakima Firing Center, which trains our troops to go to serve in the Middle East. So what were all these Middle Eastern journalists doing visiting the radio station?
Well, that's what I was going to ask. I mean, they obviously knew that all that stuff was there. And how did the tribe feel about that? Was there any?
Well, they were literally boasting of it because they had an article and a photograph in the local newspaper, but they didn't identify what country these visiting journalists were from. They didn't identify them by name or country, but the four pages the tribal member handed me had the names and country. I happen to be teaching in the Tri-Cities area of Washington State, at Kennewick, in the Masters in Public Administration, and I had a lot of students that, adult students that worked for Hanford were my students, and one of them headed up security. So I took those four pages with me, and before class I said, "I need to show you this. This needs to go somewhere, you know." And the darling little woman, she's a top security official at Hanford, but she looked like Mrs. Beasley. She was. You know, you talk about a cover. Nobody would ever suspect her of being in charge. In any event, He took the 4 pages and he says, "Don't you worry, my dear. This will get where it needs to go." And I no doubt she did, you know. But that was 10 years ago. That was before they are now congressionally authorized to bring these folks in, as of 2012. You know, so we have. That's why I wrote that article, "The Spreading Epidemic of Tribalism in America," because it's no longer just Native American domestic tribalism. We're going to be commingling it with Middle Eastern tribalism, and the goal is to take down states. Just take down states and take down property rights and take down citizen rights and dismantle this country. And it's on steroids right now. But it is such, you never hear these conversations or news in mainstream media. You don't even hear it too much on other social media and things, because this is the best kept secret. This is federal Indian policy that the only the tribal members and bureaucrats talk about it. And most people live in New York or L.A. or Sacramento, and why would you worry? When I lived in Southern California, I knew nothing about this stuff. Why would I?
Well, what we see out here, too.
It affects everybody now.
Well, in our area, what we the other thing that kind of woke me up to some of this, just I deal with it at work, but the one thing that we're seeing is the NGOs, all of the Center for Biological Diversity and the Defenders of Wildlife and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. All those guys, man, they're in thick as thieves with the tribes. And in some cases, they are the tribe. I mean, they're basically a phony tribe because none of them are actually Native Americans, but they've got themselves labeled as a tribe. And so they get to push their environmental policy using tax dollars with the clout of somebody who operates outside the Constitution. It's it's a bad deal for the regular guys.
Well, it is, and it's a really rough deal for the tribal members. It isn't the tribal members at large or, you know, as a whole that are pushing this. It is a few tribal leaders who are just totally focused on getting as much money as they can, buying as much land as they can, and getting as much jurisdictional authority as they can, and that fits with the NGOs you're speaking of, and that fits with the United Nations and Agenda 21 stuff, and it certainly fits with what President Obama is up to with the states.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's
quite a triumvirate. It's quite a little combo that is bearing down on these states.
Yeah, people are all worried that we're going to have UN police or something like that, and it's like, hey, by the way, that's not who you should actually be worried about. You ought to worry about the guys that are actually here. We need to take one more quick break, and we're going to come back with Elaine and finish off the top of the hour. So, Elaine, we won't ask you anything when we come back. We'll let you do all the talking. Since we've got to cram it all in the last few minutes. So I hope that our listeners will go to the website, wethepeopleradio.us, click on Elaine's information and book and all that, and it'll blow your mind. There's a lot more than what we've talked about.
Put Geronimo in jail down south, where it couldn't look the gift horse in the mouth. Sergeant, Sergeant, don't you feel something wrong with your automobile? Warden, Warden, listen to me. Be brave and set Geronimo free. Governor, Governor, isn't it strange? You never see a car on the Indian range. Oh, boys, take me back. I wanna ride in Geronimo's Cadillac. Oh, boys, take me back. I wanna ride in Geronimo's Cadillac.
Cowboys, and the cowboys are putting leather and turquoise on, and the music is sold by lawyers, and the fools who fiddled in the middle of the station are gone. Some folks say they'll never miss him. Old fiddles squeal like the engine brakes. Cherokee fiddle's gone forever. Just like the music of the whistle at the old locomotive made. So when you smell smoke and the cinder, just slip back your hair and open up your cage. Play a Cherokee fiddle, just play it for the whiskey. Good whiskey never lets you lose your place.
Amen to that. So that's where the Irish and the Indians have it all over. All over the other guys. So,
you folks find some wild music.
Okay, hi. How about Geronimo's Cadillac? That was funny.
You know, as a little girl, my great-grandfather used to tell stories about seeing Geronimo in jail. And then as I learned more about American history, I just had such a childhood affection for Geronimo. And so hearing that song just triggered a lot of memories. We're a country that has learned by skinning our knees. We have not done everything right. And no other country has either. And we've got more opportunities for American Indians. What troubles me is that we have cultures that preserve themselves because it's the right thing to do. The Amish is a good example, and the Hispanic, and the black culture. There are cultures that do not demand federal funding to preserve their culture because they do it out of their heart. They want to. And I think that's one of the things that's tarnishing our attitudes about American Indians. They used to be they were self-sufficient, but now they've got a very different role to play in this country, which is more of an entitlement mentality and a demand mentality, and you have to fund us for the rest of your lives because we were here first. Well, you know, we're all indentured servants to this really, really terrible system that's taking us down. It's combining with other pieces that are taking us down. And it's never benefited tribal families. I mean, if you go across any of the Indian reservations or drive through the neighborhoods, you would understand it's decades of poverty in spite of the trillions that have gone out.
You know, that's something I've noticed, and I really don't understand that. It's so visible. You go to these casinos on these reservations, and I mean, you know, they're raking in millions of dollars, and yet when you look at the reservation and how the people are living, I would think that'd be their first priority is to provide some decent housing and take care of their people.
You know what they do. And to me, this is just insidious. Many of the tribal governments and tribal cultures believe in the seven generations. And they say to their tribal members, you have to sacrifice because we have to use this money to buy land and to do things for the next seven generations. And they do this seven generations mantra. So the tribal members are being unfaithful to their government if they make too many demands because all that money is needed for seven generations. Well, it would be like me telling my granddaughter, I can't buy you shoes, I can't do this, because I have to save money for the next seven generations. That is such, you know, that is just, that's just mean. That's just mean.
It is.
But that's part of the pablum that the tribal members swallow.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
And it's a part of their spiritual process that it also keeps them locked into the poverty.
Well,
it's their duty to let the tribal government spend all the money on land and politicians and everything else, but not them.
Well, I think exposing this, you're in a very, very small group of people doing something really important. Thanks a million, Elaine. We're out of time for today, but I really do hope folks will pick up your book, Going to Pieces, The Dismantling of the United States of America, and check out the Citizens Alliance Citizens Equal Rights Alliance website. It's fabulous. You can find it all at wethepeopleradio.us. Thanks, Elaine. Next week we're talking
about Aaron and Bill and Bob. Thank all of you.
Thanks for being on.
Thanks a lot.
Appreciate the opportunity.
We're going to politics next week, folks, so we'll be talking about Iowa and all that stuff and what it means, and I think you'll like it. It'll be fun. Thanks, everybody. See you next week. wethepeopleradio.us.
Bye.